Call your regimental commander and get his drunken ass over here. What is your readiness state, Major? Keitel demanded without giving the man a chance to take a breath. The junior officer stopped in mid-reach for the phone, not knowing which order he was supposed to follow first. Well, our readiness is in accordance with unit norms, Colonel Ivanenko. You have a chance to prove that. Keitel turned to one of the others. Take this child's name. Less than 2,000 meters away, they could see lights going on at the American base in what had so recently been West Berlin. They're having a drill also, Keitel Ivanenko observed. Splendid. We'd better be faster than they are, he added. What is this? The regimental commander, also a colonel, arrived without his buttons done. This looks like a sorry spectacle, Keitel boomed. This is an unannounced readiness inspection. You have a regiment to lead, Colonel. I suggest you get to it without asking any further questions. But what? Keitel demanded. Don't you know what a readiness inspection is? There was one thing about dealing with Russians, Keitel thought. They were arrogant, overbearing, and they hated Germans, however much they protested otherwise. On the other hand, when browbeaten, they were predictable. Even though his rank insignia was no higher than this man's, he had a louder voice, and that was all he needed. I'll show you what my boys can do. We'll be outside to watch, Keitel assured him. Dr. Ryan, you'd better get down here. The line clicked off. Okay, Jack said. He grabbed his cigarettes and walked down to room 7F27, the CIA's operations center. Located on the north side of the building, it was the counterpart to operations rooms in many other government agencies. In the center of the 20-by-30-foot room, once you got past the cipher lock on the door, was a large circular table with a Lazy Susan bookcase in the center and six seats around it. The seats had overhead plaques to designate their functions. Senior duty officer, press, Africa, Latin America, Europe, USSR, Near East, terrorism, and South Asia, East Asia, Pacific. The wall clocks showed the time in Moscow, Beijing, Beirut, Tripoli, and, of course, Greenwich Mean. There was an adjacent conference room that looked down on the CIA's internal courtyard. What gives? Jack asked, arriving with Goodley in his wake. According to NORAD, a nuclear device just went off in Denver. I hope that's a fucking joke, Jack replied. That, too, was a reflex. Before the man had a chance to respond, Ryan's stomach turned over. Nobody made jokes like that one. I wish it were, the senior duty officer replied. What do we know? Not much. Anything. Threat board? Jack asked. Again, it was reflexive. If there had been anything, he would have heard it by now. Okay, where's Marcus? Coming home in the C-141, somewhere between Japan and the Aleutians. You're it, sir, the SDO pointed out, quietly thanking a beneficent god that it wasn't himself. President's at Camp David. SecDef and SecState. Dead? Ryan asked. It would appear so, sir. Ryan closed his eyes. Holy Jesus. The vice president? At his official residence. We've only been going about 3 minutes. The NMCC watch officer is a Captain James Roselli. General Wilkes is on the way in. DIA's online. The president just ordered DEFCON 2 on our strategic forces. Anything from the Russians? Nothing unusual at all. There's a regional air defense exercise underway in eastern Siberia. That's all. Okay. Alert all the stations. Put the word out that I want to hear anything they might have. Anything. They are to hit every source they can just as fast as they can. Jack paused one more time. How sure are we that this really happened? Sir, 2 DSPS satellites copied the flash. We have a KH-11 that's going to be overhead in about 20 minutes, and I've directed NPIC to put every camera they have on Denver. NORAD says it's a definite nuclear detonation, but there's no word on yield or damage. The explosion seems to be in the immediate area of the stadium. Like Black Sunday, sir, but real. This is definitely not a drill. Not if we're jacking the strategic forces to DEFCON 2, sir. Inbound ballistic track. Aircraft delivery? Negative on the first. There was no launch warning. And no ballistic radar track. What about a FOBS? Goodley asked. A weapon could be delivered by satellite. That was the purpose of a fractional orbital bombardment system. They would have caught that, the SDO replied. I already asked. On the aircraft side, they don't know yet. They're trying to check air traffic control tapes. So we don't know jack shit. Correct. President check in with us yet? Ryan asked. No, but we have an open line there. He has the National Security Advisor there also. Most likely scenario? I'd say terrorism. Ryan nodded. So would I. I'm taking over the conference room. Okay, I want DO, DI, DS&T in here immediately. If you need choppers to fetch them in, order them. Ryan walked into the room, leaving the door open. Christ, Goodley said. You sure you want me here? Yes, and when you have an idea, you say it out loud. I forgot about FOBS. Jack lifted the phone and punched the FBI button. Command Center. This is CIA, Deputy Director Ryan speaking. Who is this? Inspector Pat O'Day. I have Deputy Assistant Director Murray here also. You're on speaker, sir. Talk to me, Dan. Jack put his phone on speaker also. A watch officer handed him a cup of coffee. We don't know anything. No heads up at all, Jack. Thinking terrorists? At the moment, it seems the most plausible alternative. How sure are you of that? Sure? Ryan shook his head at the phone Goodley saw. What's sure mean, Dan? I hear you. We're still trying to figure out what happened here, too. I can't even get CNN on the TV to work. What? One of my communications people says the satellites are all out, Murray explained. Didn't you know that? No. Jack pointed for Goodley to get back into the ops center and find out. If that's true, it could scratch the terrorism idea. Jesus, that's scary. It's true, Jack. We've checked. They think 10 commercial commosats are non-functional, Goodley said. All the defense birds are online, though. Our comm links are okay. Find the most senior S&T guy you can find, or one of our commo people, and ask him what could snuff out satellites. Move, Jack ordered. Where's Shaw? On his way in. Gonna be a while, the way the roads are. Dan, I'll give you everything I get here. It'll be a two-way street. The line went dead. The most horrible thing was that Ryan didn't know what to do next. It was his job to gather data and forward it to the president, but he had no data. What information there was would come in through military circuits. CIA had failed again, Ryan told himself. Someone had done something to his country and he hadn't warned anyone. People were dead because his agency had failed in its mission. Ryan was deputy director, the man who really ran the shop for the political drone placed over his head. The failure was personal. A million people dead, maybe. And there he was, all alone in an elegant little conference room staring at a wall with nothing on it. He hunted a line to NORAD and punched it. NORAD, a disembodied voice answered. This is the CIA Operations Center, Deputy Director Ryan speaking. I need information. We do not have much, sir. We think the bomb exploded in the immediate vicinity of the Sky Dome. We are trying to estimate yield, but nothing yet. A helicopter has been dispatched from Lowry Air Force Base. Will you keep us posted? Yes, sir. Thank you. That was a big help, Ryan thought. Now he knew that someone else didn't know anything. There was nothing magical about a mushroom cloud, Battalion Chief Mike Callahan of the Denver City Fire Department knew. He'd seen one before, as a rookie firefighter. It had been a fire in the Burlington Yards just outside the city in 1968. A propane tank car had let go right next to another trainload of bombs en route to the Navy's munitions terminal at Oakland, California. The chief back then had had the good sense to pull his men back when the tank ruptured, and from a quarter mile away they'd watched 100 tons of bombs go off in a hellish firecracker series. There had been a mushroom then also. A large mass of hot air rose, roiling as it went into an annular shape. It created an updraft, drawing air upward into its donut-shaped center, making the stem of the mushroom. But this one was much larger. He was behind the wheel of his red-painted command car, following the first alarm, 3 Seagrave pumper units, an aerial ladder truck, and 2 ambulances. It was a pitiful first response. Callahan lifted his radio and ordered a general alarm. Next, he ordered his men to approach from upwind. Christ, what had happened here? It couldn't be that. Most of the city was still intact. Chief Callahan didn't know much, but he knew there was a fire to fight and people to rescue. As his car turned off the last side street onto the boulevard leading to the stadium, he saw the main smoke mass. The parking lot, of course. It had to be. The mushroom cloud was blowing rapidly southwest toward the mountains. The parking lot was a mass of fire and flame from burning gasoline and oil and auto parts. A powerful gust of wind cleared the smoke briefly, just enough that he could see that there had been a stadium here. A few sections were still not intact, but you could tell what they were, had been, only a few minutes before. Callahan shut that out. He had a fire to fight. He had people to rescue. The first pump unit pulled up at a hydrant. They had good water here. The stadium was fully sprinklered, and that system fed off 2 36-inch high-pressure mains that gridded around the complex. He parked his car next to the first big Seagrave and left it to climb on top of the fire engine. Some heavy structural material. The stadium roof, he supposed, was in the parking lot to his right. Moore had landed a quarter mile away in the mercifully empty parking lot of a shopping center. Callahan used his portable radio to order the next wave of rescue units to check both the shopping center and the residential area that lay beyond it. The smaller fires would have to wait. There were people in the stadium who needed help, but his firefighters would have to fight through 200 yards of burning cars to get to them. Just then he looked up to see a blue Air Force rescue helicopter. The UH-1N landed 30 yards away. Callahan ran over toward it. The officer inside the back, he saw, was an Army major. "Callahan," he said, "battalion chief." "Griggs," the major replied. "You need a look around?" "Right." "Okay." The major spoke into his headset and the helicopter lifted off. Callahan grabbed a seatbelt but didn't strap in. It didn't take long. What appeared to be a wall of smoke from street level became discrete pillars of black and gray smoke from overhead. Perhaps half of the cars had ignited. He could use one of the driving lanes to get closer in, but some of the way was blocked by wrecked and burning cars. The chopper made a single circuit, bouncing through the roiled hot air. Looking down, Callahan could see a mass of melted asphalt, some of it still glowing red. The only spot not giving off smoke was the south end of the stadium itself, which seemed to glisten, though he didn't know why. What they could see appeared to be a crater whose dimensions were hard to judge, since they could only catch bits and pieces of it at a time. It took a long look to determine that parts of the stadium structure remained standing, perhaps 4 or 5 sections, Callahan thought. There had to be people in there. "Okay, I've seen enough," Callahan told Griggs. The officer handed him a headset so that they could speak coherently. "What is this?"
"Just what it looks like, far as I can tell," Griggs replied.
"What do you need?"
"Heavy lift and rigging equipment. There are probably people in what's left of the stadium. We gotta get into them."
"But what about the... what about radiation?"
The major shrugged.
"I don't know. When I leave here, I'm picking up a team from Rocky Flats. I work at the arsenal, and I know a little about this, but the specialists are at Rocky Flats. There's a Nest team there. I need to get them down here ASAP. "Okay, I'll call the guard people at the arsenal. We can get the heavy equipment down here fast. Keep your people to windward. Keep your people at this end. Do not attempt to approach from any other direction, okay?"
"Right."
"Set up a decontamination station right there where your engines are. When people come out, hose them down. Strip them and hose them down. Understand?" the major asked as the chopper touched down. "Then get them to the nearest hospital. Upwind. Remember that everything has to go northeast into the wind so you know you're safe."
"What about fallout?"
"I'm no expert, but I'll give you the best I got. Looks like it was a small one. Not much fallout. The suction from the fireball and the surface wind should have driven most of the radioactive shit away from here. Not all, but most. It should be okay for an hour or so. Exposure, I mean. By that time, I'll have the Nest guys here, and they can tell you for sure. Best I can do for now, Chief. Good luck.
Callahan jumped out and ran clear. The chopper lifted right off, heading northwest for Rocky Flats.
Well? Kuropatkin asked. General, we measure yield by the initial and residual heat emissions. There is something odd about this, but my best figure is between 150 and 200 kilotons.
The major showed his commander the calculations.
What's odd about it? The energy from the initial flash was low. That might mean some clouds were in the way. The residual heat is quite high. This was a major detonation, comparable to a very large tactical warhead or a small strategic one.
Here's the target book, a lieutenant said. It was just that, a cloth-bound, quarto-sized volume whose thick pages were actually fold-out maps. It was intended for use in strike damage evaluation. The map of the Denver area had a plastic overlay that showed the targeting of Soviet strategic missiles. A total of 8 birds were detailed on the city, 5 SS-18s and 3 SS-19s, totaling no fewer than 64 warheads and 20 megatons of yield. Someone, Kuropatkin reflected, thought Denver a worthy target.
We're assuming a ground burst, Kuropatkin asked.
Correct, the major replied. He used a compass to draw a circle centered on the stadium complex.
A 200 kiloton device would have a lethal blast radius this wide.
The map was color-coded. Hard-to-kill structures were colored brown. Dwellings were yellow. Green denoted commercial and other buildings deemed easy targets to destroy. The stadium, he saw, was green, as was nearly everything immediately around it. Well inside the lethal radius were hundreds of houses and low-rise apartment buildings.
How many in the stadium?
I called KGB for an estimate, the lieutenant said.
It's an enclosed structure, with a roof. The Americans like their comforts. Total capacity is over 60,000.
My God, General Kuropatkin breathed.
60,000 there. At least another 100,000 inside this radius. The Americans must be insane by now. And if they think we did it.
Well, Borstein asked. I ran the numbers 3 times. Best guess, 150 KT, sir, the captain said.
Borstein rubbed his face.
Christ. Casualty count?
200 K, based on computer modeling and a quick look at the maps we have on file, she answered.
Sir, if somebody's thinking terrorist device, they're wrong. It's too big for that.
Borstein activated the conference line to the president and SyncSec.
We have some early numbers here.
Okay, I'm waiting, the president said. He stared at the speaker as though it were a person. Initial yield estimates look like 150 kilotons.
That big? General Fremont's voice asked.
We checked the numbers 3 times.
Casualties? SyncSec asked next.
On the order of 200,000 initial dead. Add 50 more to that from delayed effects. President Fowler recoiled backwards as though slapped across the face. For the past 5 minutes he had denied as much as he could. This most important of denials had just vanished. 200,000 people dead. His citizens. The people he'd sworn to preserve, protect, and defend.
What else? His voice asked.
I didn't catch that, Borstein said. Fowler took a deep breath and spoke again.
What else do you have?
Sir, our impression here is that the yield is awfully high for a terrorist device.
I'd have to concur in that, SyncSec said. An IND, an improvised nuclear device, that is, what we'd expect from unsophisticated terrorists, should not be much more than 20 KT. This sounds like a multi-stage weapon.
Multi-stage? Elliot said toward the speaker.
A thermonuclear device, General Borstein replied. An H-bomb.
Ryan here. Who's this?
Major Fox, sir, at NORAD.
We have an initial feel for yield and casualties. The major read off the bomb numbers.
Too big for a terrorist weapon, said an officer from the Directorate of Science and Technology.
That's what we think, sir.
Casualties? Ryan asked.
Probable prompt kill number is 200,000 or so. That includes the people at the stadium.
I have to wake up, Ryan told himself, his eyes screwed tightly shut. This has to be a fucking nightmare, and I'm going to wake up from it. But he opened his eyes, and nothing had changed at all.
Robbie Jackson was sitting in the cabin of the carrier's skipper, Captain Ernie Richards. They had been half listening to the game, but mainly discussing tactics for an upcoming war game. The Theodore Roosevelt battle group would approach Israel from the west, simulating an attacking enemy. The enemy in this case was the Russians. It seemed highly unlikely, of course, but you had to set some rules for the game. The Russians in this case were going to be clever. The battle group would be broken up to resemble a loose assembly of merchant ships instead of a tactical formation. The first attack wave would be fighters and attack bombers squawking international on their IFF boxes and would try to approach Ben-Gurion International Airport in the guise of peaceful airliners, the better to get inside Israeli airspace unannounced. Jackson's operations people had already purloined airliner schedules and were examining the time factors, the better to make their first attack seem as plausible as possible. The odds against them were long. It was not expected that TR could do much more than annoy the IAF and the new USAF contingent. But Jackson liked long odds.
Turn up the radio, Rob. I forgot what the score is.
Jackson leaned across the table and turned the dial, but got music. The carrier had her own onboard TV system and was also radio-tuned to the U.S. Armed Forces network.
Maybe the antenna broke, the air wing commander observed.
Richards laughed.
At a time like this, I could have a mutiny aboard. That would look good on the old fit rep, wouldn't it?
Someone knocked at the door.
Come,
Richards said. It was a yeoman. Flash traffic, sir. The petty officer handed the clipboard over.
Anything important? Robbie asked.
Richards just handed the message over. Then he lifted the growler phone and punched up the bridge.
General quarters.
What the hell?
Jackson murmured.
DEFCON 3?
What?
For Christ's sake.
Ernie Richards, a former attack pilot, had a reputation as something of a character. He'd reinstituted the traditional Navy practice of bugle calls to announce drills. In this case, the 1MC speaker system blared forth the opening bars of John Williams' frantic call to arms in Star Wars, followed by the usual electronic gonging.
Let's go, Rob.
Both men started running down to the Combat Information Center.
What can you tell me? Andrei Ilyich Narmanov asked. The bomb had a force of nearly 200 kilotons. That means a large device, a hydrogen bomb, General Kuropatkin said. The death count will be well over 100,000 dead. We also have indications of a strong electromagnetic pulse that struck one of our early warning satellites.
What could account for that?
The questioner here was one of Narmanov's military advisors.
We do not know. Do we have any nuclear weapons unaccounted for?
Kuropatkin heard his president ask.
Absolutely not, a third voice replied.
Anything else?
With your permission, I would like to order Voiska PVO to a higher alert level. We already have a training exercise underway in eastern Siberia.
Is that provocative? Narmanov asked.
No, it is totally defensive. Our interceptors cannot harm anyone more than a few hundred kilometers from our own borders. For the moment, I will keep all my aircraft within Soviet airspace.
Very well. You may proceed.
In his underground control center, Kuropatkin merely pointed to another officer who lifted a phone. The Soviet air defense system had already been prepped, of course. Inside a minute, radio messages were being broadcast, and long-range search radars came on all over the country's periphery.
Both the messages and the radar signals were immediately detected by National Security Agency assets, both on the ground and in orbit.
Anything else I should do? Narmanov asked his advisors.
A foreign ministry official spoke for all of them.
I think doing nothing is probably best. When Fowler wishes to speak with us, he will do so. He has trouble enough without our interfering.
The American Airlines MD-80 landed at Miami International Airport and taxied over to the terminal. Cotty and Gone rose from their first-class seats and left the aircraft. Their bags would be transferred automatically to the connecting flight. Not that either one particularly cared about that, of course. Both men were nervous, but less so than one might have expected. Death was something both had accepted as an overt possibility for this mission. If they survived, so much the better. Gone didn't panic until he realized that there was no unusual activity at all. There should have been some, he thought. He found a bar and looked for the usual elevated television set. It was tuned to a local station. There was no game coverage. He debated asking a question, but decided not to. It was a good decision. He had only to wait a minute before he overheard another voice asking what the score was.
It was 14-7 Vikings, another voice answered. Then the goddamn signal was lost.
When?
About 10 minutes ago.
Funny they don't have it back yet.
Earthquake? Like the series game in San Francisco?
Your guess is as good as mine, man, the bartender replied.
Gone stood and left for the walk back to the departure lounge. What does CIA have? Fowler asked.
Nothing at the moment, sir. We're collecting data, but you know everything that we...
Wait a minute. Ryan took the message form that the senior duty officer handed him.
Sir, I have a flash here from NSA. The Russian air defense system just went to a higher alert level. Radars are all coming on, and there's a lot of radio chatter.
What does that mean?
Liz Elliott asked.
It means that they want to increase their ability to protect themselves. PVO isn't a threat to anybody unless they're approaching or inside Soviet airspace.
But why would they do it? Elliot asked again.
Maybe they're afraid somebody will attack them.
God damn it, Ryan, the president shouted.
Mr. President, excuse me. That was not a flippant remark. It is literally true. Voyska PVO is a defense system like our NORAD. Our air defense and warning systems are now at a higher alert status. So are theirs. It's a defensive move only. They have to know that we've had this event. When there's trouble of this sort, it's natural to activate your own defenses, just as we have done.
It's potentially disturbing, General Borstein said at NORAD HQ.
Ryan, you forget we have been attacked. They have not. Now, before they've even bothered to call us, they're jacking up their alert levels. I find that a little worrisome.
Ryan, what about those reports that we got about missing Soviet nuclear weapons? Fowler asked. Could that fit into this situation?
What missing nukes? Sinksack demanded. Why the hell didn't I hear about that?
What kind of nukes? Borstein asked a second later.
There was an unconfirmed report from a penetration agent. There are no details, Ryan answered, then realized he had to press on. The sum of the information received is this. We've been told that Narmanov has political problems with his military, that they are unhappy with the way he's doing things, that in the ongoing pullback from Germany, an unspecified number of nuclear weapons, probably tactical ones, have turned up missing, that KGB is conducting an operation to determine what, if anything, is missing. Supposedly, Narmanov is personally concerned that he might be the target of political blackmail, and that the blackmail could have a nuclear dimension. But, and I must emphasize the but, we have been totally unable to confirm these reports despite repeated attempts, and we are examining the possibility that our agent is lying to us.
Why didn't you tell us that? Fowler asked.
Mr. President, we're in the process of formulating our assessment now. The work is still ongoing, sir. I mean, we've been doing it over the weekend.
Well, it sure as hell wasn't one of ours, General Fremont said heatedly.
And it's no goddamn terrorist bomb. It's too goddamn big for that. Now you tell us that the Russians may have a short inventory. That's more than disturbing, Ryan.
And it could explain the increased alert level at PVO, Borstein added ominously.
Are you two telling me, the president asked, that this could have been a Soviet device?
There aren't all that many nuclear powers around, Borstein replied first. And the yield of this device is just too damned big for amateurs.
Wait a minute, Jack jumped in again. You have to remember that the facts we have here are very thin. There is a difference between information and speculation. You have to remember that.
How big are Soviet tactical nuclear weapons?
Liz Elliott wanted to know.
SyncSac handled that one. A lot like ours. They have little 1 kiloton ones for artillery rounds, and they have warheads up to 500 kt left over from the SS-20s they did away with.
In other words, the yield of this explosion falls into the range of the Soviet warhead types that we have heard are missing?
Correct, Dr. Elliott, General Fremont replied.
At Camp David, Elizabeth Elliott leaned back in her chair and turned to the president. She spoke too softly for the speakerphone to catch her words.
Robert, you were supposed to be at that game, along with Brent and Dennis.
It was strange that he hadn't had that thought enter his mind yet, Fowler told himself. He too leaned back.
No,
he replied. I cannot believe that the Russians would attempt such a thing.
What was that? A voice on the speaker asked.
Wait a minute, the president said too quietly.
Mr. President, I didn't catch what you said.
I said wait a minute, Fowler shouted. He put his hand over the speaker for a moment.
Elizabeth, it's our job to get control of this situation, and we will. Let's try to put this personal stuff aside for the moment.
Mr. President, I want you on kneecap just as fast as you can get there, SyncSac said. This situation could be very serious indeed.
If we're going to get control, Robert, we must do it quickly.
Fowler turned to the naval officer standing behind him. When's the chopper due in?
25 minutes, sir. Then 30 more to get you to Andrews for kneecap.
Almost an hour. Fowler looked at the wall clock, as people do when they know what time it is, know what time it will take to do something, and look at the clock anyway.
The radio links on the chopper aren't enough for this. Tell the chopper to take Vice President Durling to kneecap. General Fremont?
Yes, Mr. President.
You have extra kneecaps there, don't you?
Yes, I do, sir.
I'm sending the Vice President up on the primary. You send a spare down here. You can land it at Hagerstown, can't you?
Yes, sir. We can use the Fairchild Republic airfield, where they used to build the A-10s.
Okay, do that. It'll take me an hour to get to Andrews, and I cannot afford to waste an hour. It's my job to settle this thing down, and I need that hour.
That, sir, is a mistake, Fremont said in the coldest voice he had. It would take 2 hours to get the aircraft to Central Maryland.
That may be, but it's what I'm going to do. This is not a time for me to run away.
Behind the president, Pete Connor and Helen D'Agostino traded a baleful look. They had no illusions on what would happen if there were a nuclear attack on the United States. Mobility was the president's best defense, and he had just thrown that away. The radio message from Camp David went out at once. The presidential helicopter was just crossing the Washington Beltway when it turned and went back southeast. It landed on the grounds of the U.S. Naval Observatory. Vice President Roger Durling and his entire family jumped aboard. They didn't even bother strapping in. Secret Service agents, with their Uzi submachine guns out, knelt inside the aircraft. All Durling knew was what the Secret Service detail had told him. Durling told himself that he had to relax, that he had to keep his head. He looked at his youngest child, a boy only 4 years old. To be that age again. He'd thought only the day before, to be that age again and be able to grow up in a world where the chance of a major war no longer existed. All the horrors of his youth, the Cuban Missile Crisis that had marked his freshman year in college, his service as a platoon leader in the 82nd Airborne,
a year of which had been in Vietnam. War experience made Derling a most unusual liberal politician. He hadn't run from it. He'd taken his chances and remembered having two men die in his arms. Just yesterday he'd looked at his son and thanked God that he wouldn't have to know any of that. And now, this. His son still didn't know anything more than that they were getting a surprise helicopter ride, and he loved to fly. His wife knew more, and there were tears streaming from her eyes, and she stared back at him. The Marine VH-3 touched down within 50 yards of the aircraft. The first Secret Service agent leaped off and saw a platoon of Air Force security police marking the way to the stairs. The Vice President was practically dragged toward them, while a burly agent picked up his young son and ran the distance. 2 minutes later, before people had even strapped in, the pilot of the National Emergency Airborne Command Post, NECAP, firewalled his engines and roared down runway 01 left. He headed east for the Atlantic Ocean, where a KC-10 tanker was already orbiting to top off the Boeing's tanks. "We have a major problem here," Rick said in the maneuvering room. Maine had just tried to move. At any speed over 3 knots, the propeller screeched like a banshee. The shaft was slightly bent, but they'd live with that for a while. "All 7 blades must be damaged. If we try for anything over 3, we make noise. Over 5 and we'll lose the shaft bearings in a matter of minutes. The outboard motor can give us 2 or 3 knots, but that's noisy, too. Comments?" There were none. No one aboard doubted Rick's engineering expertise. "Options?" "Kinda thin, aren't they?" Dutch Claggett observed. Maine had to stay near the surface. At this alert level, she had to be ready to launch in minutes. Ordinarily, they could have gone to a deeper depth, if for no other reason than to reduce the horrible motion the ship was taking right now from surface turbulence. But her reduced speed made coming up too time-consuming. "How close is Omaha?" the chief engineer asked. "Probably within 100 miles. But there's P-3s at Kodiak." "But we still have that Akula out there to worry about," Claggett said.
"Sir, we can hang tough right here and wait it out."
"No. We have a hurt boomer. We need some kind of support."
"That means radiating," the XO pointed out.
"We'll use a slot buoy."
"At 2 knots through the water, that doesn't buy us much, sir."
"Captain, radiating is a mistake."
Ricks looked at his chief engineer, who said, "I like the idea of having a friend around."
"So do I," the captain said. It didn't take long. The buoy was on the surface in seconds and immediately began broadcasting a short message in UHF. It was programmed to continue broadcasting for hours.
"We're going to have a nationwide panic on our hands," Fowler said. That was not his most penetrating observation. He had a growing panic in his own command center and knew it.
"Is there anything coming out of Denver?"
"Nothing on any commercial TV or radio channel that I know of," a voice at NORAD replied.
"Okay, you people stand by." Fowler searched his panel for another button.
"FBI command center, Inspector O'Day speaking."
"This is the President," Fowler said unnecessarily. It was a direct line, and the light on the FBI panel was neatly labeled. "Who's in charge down there?"
"I am Deputy Assistant Director Murray, Mr. President. I'm the senior man at the moment."
"How are your communications?"
"They're okay, sir. We have access to the military comsats."
"One thing we have to worry about is a nationwide panic. To prevent that, I want you to send people to all the TV network headquarters. I want your people to explain to them that they may not broadcast anything about this. If necessary, you are directed to use force to prevent it."
Murray didn't like that.
"Mr. President, that is against..."
"I know the law, okay? I used to be a prosecutor. This is necessary to preserve life and order, and it will be done, Mr. Murray. That is a presidential order. Get to it."
"Yes, sir."
Chapter 38. First Contacts.
The various communications satellite operators were fiercely independent companies and very often ruthless competitors, but they were not enemies. Between them were agreements informally called treaties. There was always the possibility that one satellite or another could go down, whether from an internal breakdown or a collision with space debris that was becoming a real worry for them. Accordingly, there were mutual assistance agreements specifying that in the event one operator lost a bird, his associates would take up the slack, just as newspapers in the same city traditionally agreed to share printing facilities in the event of a fire or natural disaster. To back up these agreements, there were open phone lines between the various corporate headquarters. Intelsat was the first to call Telstar.
"Bert, we just had two birds go down," Intelsat's duty engineer reported in a slightly shaken voice.
"What gives?"
"Shit, we just lost three. And Westar 4 and Teleglobe are down, too. We've had complete system failures here. Running checks now. You?"
"Same here, Bert. Any ideas?"
"None. We're talking like nine birds down, Stacy. Fuck!" The man paused.
"Ideas?
Wait a minute. Getting something. Okay, it's software. We're interrogating 301 now. They got spiked.
Jesus! 301 got spiked on over 100 freaks. Somebody just tried to zorch us.
That's how it looks here, too.
But who?
Sure as hell wasn't a hacker. This would take megawatts to do that on just one channel.
Bert, that's exactly what I'm getting. Phone links, everything spiked at once.
You in any hurry to light them back up?
You kidding me?
I got a billion worth of hardware up there. Till I find out what the hell clobbered them, they stay down. I've got my senior VP on the way in now.
The prez was out in Denver, Bert added.
Mine too, but my chief engineer is snowed in. Damned if I'm going to put my ass on the line.
I think we should cooperate on this, Bert.
No arguments with me, Stace. I'll whistle up Fred Kent at Hughes and see what he thinks. It'll take a while for us to review everything and do full systems checks. I'm staying down until I know, and I mean know what happened here. You got an industry to protect, man.
Agreed.
I won't light back up without talking to you. Keep me posted on anything you find out.
You got it, Bert.
I'll be back to you in an hour, one way or another.
The Soviet Union is a vast country, by far the largest in the world, both in area and in the expanse of its borders. All of those borders are guarded, since both the current country and all its precursors have been invaded many times. Border defenses include the obvious, troop concentrations, airfields, and radar posts, and the subtle, like radio reception antennas. The latter were designed to listen in on radio and other electronic emissions. The information was passed on by landline or microwave links to Moscow Center, the headquarters of the Committee for State Security, the KGB, at number 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. The KGB's 8th Chief Directorate is tasked to communications intelligence and communications security. It has a long and distinguished history that has benefited from another traditional Russian strength, a fascination with theoretical mathematics. The relationship between ciphers and mathematics is a logical one, and the most recent manifestation of this was the work of a bearded, 30-ish gnome of a man who was fascinated with the work of Benoit Mandelbrot at Harvard University, the man who had effectively invented fractal geometry. Uniting this work with that of Mackenzie's work on chaos theory at Cambridge University in England, the young Russian genius had invented a genuinely new theoretical way of looking at mathematical formulae. It was generally conceded by that handful of people who understood what he was talking about that his work was easily worth a Planck medal. It was an historical accident that his father happened to be a general in the KGB's Chief Border Guards Directorate, and that as a result the Committee for State Security had taken immediate note of his work. The mathematician now had everything a grateful motherland could offer, and someday he'd probably have that Planck medal also. He'd needed 2 years to make his theoretical breakthrough into something practical, but 15 months earlier he'd made his first recovery from the U.S. State Department's most secure cipher, called Stripe.
6 months after that, he'd proven conclusively that it was similar in structure to everything the U.S. military used. Cross-checking with another team of cryptanalysts who had access to the work of the Walker spy ring, and the even more serious work done by Pelton, what had resulted only 6 months earlier was a systematic penetration of American encryption systems. It was still not perfect. Daily keying procedures occasionally proved impossible to break. Sometimes they went as much as a week without recovering one message, but they'd gone as many as 3 days recovering over half of what they received, and their results were improving by the month. Indeed, the main problem seemed to be that they didn't have the computer hardware to do all the work they should have been able to do, and the Eighth Directorate was busily training more linguists to handle the message traffic they were receiving. Sergei Nikolaevich Golovko had been awakened from a sound sleep and driven to his office to add his name to the people all over the world, shocked into frightened sobriety. A first chief directorate man all of his life, his job was to examine the collective American mind and advise his president on what was going on. The decrypts flooding onto his desk were the most useful tool. He had no less than 30 such messages, which bore one of two messages. All strategic forces were being ordered to Defense Condition 2, and all conventional forces were coming to Defense Condition 3. The American president was panicking, KGB's first deputy chairman thought. There was no other explanation. Was it possible that he thought the Soviet Union had committed this infamy? That was the most frightening thought of his life. Another one. Naval one. The messenger dropped it on his desk. Golovko needed only one look. Flash this to the Navy immediately. He had to call his president with the rest. Golovko lifted the phone. For once, the Soviet bureaucracy worked quickly. Minutes later, an extremely low-frequency signal went out, and the submarine Admiral Lunin went to the surface to copy the full message. Captain Dubinin read it as the printer generated it. American submarine USS Maine reports location as 50 degrees, 55 minutes, 09 seconds north, 153 degrees, 01 minutes, 23 seconds west. Propeller disabled by collisions of unknown cause. Dubinin left the communications room and made for the chart table. Where were we when we copied that transient? Here, Captain. And the bearing was here. The navigator traced the line with his pencil. Dubinin just shook his head. He handed the message over. Look at this. What do you suppose he's doing? He'll be close to the surface. So, we'll go up, just under the layer, and we'll move quickly. Surface noise will play hell with his sonar. 15 knots. You suppose he was following us? Took you long enough to realize that, didn't it? Dubinin measured the distance to the target. Very proud, this one. We'll see about that. You know how the Americans boast of taking hull photographs. Now, my young lieutenant, now it will be our turn. What does this mean? Narmanov asked the first deputy chairman. The Americans have been attacked by forces unknown, and the attack was serious, causing major loss of life. It is to be expected that they will increase their military readiness. A major consideration will be the maintenance of public order, Golovko replied over the secure phone line. And? And, unfortunately, all their strategic weapons happen to be aimed at the Rodina. But we had no part in this, the Soviet president objected. Correct. You see, such responses are automatic. They are planned in advance and become almost reflexive moves. Once attacked, you become highly cautious. Counter moves are planned in advance so that you may act rapidly while applying your intellectual capacities to an analysis of the problem without additional and unnecessary distractions. The Soviet president turned to his defense minister. So, what should we do? I advise an increase in our alert status. Defensive only, of course.
Whoever conducted this attack might, after all, attempt to strike us also.
Approved, Narmanov said bluntly. Highest peacetime alert. Golovko frowned at his telephone receiver. His choice of words had been exquisitely correct, reflexive.
May I make a suggestion?
Yes, the defense minister said.
If it is possible, perhaps it would be well to tell our forces the reason for the alert. It might lessen the shock of the order.
It's a needless complication, defense thought.
The Americans have not done this, Golovko said urgently, and that was almost certainly a mistake. Please consider the state of mind of people suddenly taken from ordinary peacetime operations to an elevated state of alert. It will only require a few additional words. Those few words could be important.
Good idea, Narmanov thought. Make it so, he ordered defense.
We will soon hear from the Americans on the hotline, Narmanov said. What will they say?
That is hard to guess, but whatever it is, we should have a reply ready for them, just to settle things down, to make sure they know we had nothing to do with it.
Narmanov nodded. That made good sense.
Start working on it.
The Soviet Defense Communications Agency operators grumbled at the signal they'd been ordered to dispatch. For ease of transmission, the meat of the signal should have been contained in a single five-letter code group that could be transmitted, decrypted, and comprehended instantly by all recipients. But that was not possible now. The additional sentences had to be edited down to keep the transmission from being too long. A major did this, got it approved by his boss, a major general, and sent it out over no less than 30 communications links. The message was further altered to apply to specific military services. The Admiral Lunin had only been on her new course for 5 minutes when a second ELF signal arrived. The communications officer fairly ran into the control room with it.
General Alert Level 2. There has been a nuclear detonation of unknown origin in the United States. American strategic and conventional forces have been alerted for possible war. All naval forces will sortie at once. Take all necessary protective measures.
Has the world gone mad?
The captain asked the message. He got no reply.
That's all.
That is all. No queuing to put the antenna up.
These are not proper instructions, Dobynin objected.
All necessary protective measures. What do they mean by that? Protecting ourselves, protecting the motherland. What the hell do they mean?
Captain, the Starpom said,
General Alert 2 carries its own rules of action.
I know that, Dobynin said, but do they apply here?
Why else would the signal have been sent?
A level 2 general alert was something unprecedented for the Soviet military. It meant that the rules of action were not those of a war, but not those of peace either. Though Dobynin, like every other Soviet ship captain, fully understood his duties, the implications of the order seemed far too frightening. The thought passed, however. He was a naval officer. He had his orders. Whoever had given those orders must have understood the situation better than he. The commanding officer of the Admiral Lunin stood erect and turned to his second in command.
Increase speed to 25 knots.
Battle stations. It happened just as fast as men could move. The New York FBI office, set in the Jacob Javits Federal Office Building on the southern end of Manhattan, dispatched its men north, and the light Sunday traffic made it easy. The unmarked but powerful cars screamed uptown to the various network headquarters buildings. The same thing happened in Atlanta, where agents left the Martin Luther King Building for CNN headquarters. In each case, no fewer than 3 agents marched into the master control rooms and laid down the law. Nothing from Denver would go out. In no case did the network employees know why this was so. So busy were they trying to reestablish contact. The same thing happened in Colorado, where under the direction of Assistant Special Agent in Charge Walter Hoskins, the local field division's agents invaded all the network affiliates
and the local phone company, where they cut all long-distance lines over the furious objections of the Bell employees. But Hoskins had made one mistake. It came from the fact that he didn't watch much television. KOLD was an independent station that was also trying to become a superstation. Like TBS, WWOR, and a few others, it had its own satellite link to cover a wide viewing area. A daring financial gamble, it had not yet paid off for the investors who were running the station on a highly leveraged shoestring out of an old and almost windowless building northeast of the city. The station used one of the Annex series Canadian satellites and reached Alaska, Canada, and the North Central U.S. reasonably well with its programming, which was mainly old network shows. The KOLD building had once been Denver's first network television station and was constructed in the pattern originally required by the Federal Communications Commission in the 1930s. Monolithic reinforced concrete, fit to survive an enemy bomb attack. The specifications predated nuclear weapons. The only windows were in the executive offices on the south side of the building. It was 10 minutes after the event that someone passed by the open door of the program manager. He stopped cold, turned, and ran back to the newsroom. In another minute, a cameraman entered onto the freight elevator that ran all the way to the roof. The picture, hardwired into the control room and then sent out on a KU-band transmitter to the Annex satellite, which was untouched by earlier events, broke into the reruns of The Adventures of Dobie Gillis across Alaska, Montana, North Dakota, Idaho, and three Canadian provinces. In Calgary, Alberta, a reporter for a local paper who'd never got over her crush on Dwayne Hickman was startled by the picture and the voiceover and called her city desk. Her breathless report went out at once on the Reuters wire. Soon thereafter, CBC uplinked the video to Europe on one of their unaffected Annex satellites. By that time, the Denver FBI had a pair of men entering the KOLD building. They laid down the law to a news crew that protested about the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which argument carried less weight than the men with guns who shut the power down to their transmitter. The FBI agents at least apologized as they did so. They needn't have bothered. What had been a fool's errand from the beginning was already an exercise in futility. "So what the hell is going on?" Richards asked his staff.
"We have no idea, sir." "No reason was given for the alert," the communications officer said lamely.
"Well, it leaves us between two chairs, doesn't it?" This was a rhetorical question. The TR battle group was just passing Malta and was now in range of targets in the Soviet Union. That required the Styx A6E intruders to take off, climb rapidly to cruising altitude, and top off their tanks soon thereafter. But at that point, they had the gas to make it all the way to their targets on or near the Kerch Peninsula. Only a year before, U.S. Navy carriers, though carrying a sizable complement of thermonuclear bombs, had not been part of the SIOP. This acronym, pronounced PSIOP, stood for Single Integrated Operations Plan, and was the master blueprint for dismantling the Soviet Union. The drawdown of strategic missiles, mostly land-based ones for the United States, had radically reduced the number of available warheads, and, like planners everywhere, the Joint Strategic Targeting Staff, co-located with Headquarters SAC, tried to make up for the shortfall in any way they could. As a result, whenever an aircraft carrier was in range of Soviet targets, it assumed its PSYOP tasking. In the case of USS Theodore Roosevelt, it meant that about the time the ship passed east of Malta, she became not a conventional theater force, but a nuclear strategic force. To fulfill this mission, TR carried 50 B-61 Mod 8 nuclear gravity bombs in a special heavily guarded magazine. The B-61 had FUFO, for Full Fusing Option, more commonly called dial-a-yield, that selected an explosive power ranging from 10 to 500 kilotons. The bombs were 12 feet long, less than a foot in diameter, weighed a mere 700 pounds, and were nicely streamlined to cut air resistance. Each A6E could carry two of them, with all of its other hardpoints occupied by auxiliary fuel tanks to allow a combat radius of more than 1,000 miles. 10 of them were the explosive equivalent of a whole squadron of Minuteman missiles. Their assigned targets were naval, on the principle that people most often kill friends, or at least associates, rather than total strangers.
One assigned PSYOP mission, for example, was to reduce the Nikolaev shipyard on the Dnieper River to a radioactive puddle.